Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
We're pleased to welcome Phil Connors here to discuss and sign his new book, All the Wrong Places, a memoir of his brother's shocking death, told with great pathos and unexpected humor. Please help us welcome Phil Connors.
Thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you, brave souls, for... I think the temperature is something like 12 degrees, the wind is howling, it's snowing... And the fact that anybody is here tonight is no small miracle. So, thank you. I thought I'd start by just reaching back to my first book, Fire Season, which I'm very happy to say sold more copies in the Denver metro area than in any other metropolitan area in the United States of America, thanks to the good booksellers of the Tattered Cover, in large part, who were huge boosters of this book early on, and in particular, the indefatigable Jackie Blem, who blogged about it kindly, and really helped get this book into readers' hands, readers who care about the outdoors and wildfire, subjects very much dear to the heart of people who live around Denver. So I just want to read a little passage here, if I can find it, from the first chapter of Fire Season. It hints at something that gets taken up in the new book, All the Wrong Places. So one of the peculiarities of my summer job as a fire lookout in the Gila National Forest is that my supplies for the summer are packed in by mule packers. This is an ancient art that is practiced by a dwindling number of people, but every spring, I pack 300 to 400 pounds of non-perishable food, my typewriter, a little bit of whiskey, and other necessities, and get it packed in on mules to a mountaintop 5 miles from the road in the Black Range of the Gila National Forest in southern New Mexico. And one of the times this happened, the season I write about in the book, 2009, the two guys who brought my supplies unloaded them, and then one of them asked me a question. "You ever get lonely up here?" To which I answered, "No, not really." And then Cameron said, "You ever get, you know, sad or anything like that?" This requires a thoughtful response. Sad is too small and mean a word for the feelings this place evokes in me. Yet I'd be lying to say I live here in a state of perpetual ecstasy, like the blissed-out bodhisattva Kerouac dreamed of becoming. On the other hand, I'm not about to tell two guys in leather chaps and cowboy hats about my very real and near mystical hours of longing and nostalgia, alone in my little glass box, brooding over and exulting in my own mortality amid mountains silently magisterial in the late day sun. Nor of the hours sitting and staring into the inscrutable heart of the desert, not thinking anything, not feeling anything, neither happy nor sad nor any quantifiable mixture thereof, merely alive with a hungry retina and a taste for dry mountain country and a Jones for the sight of that first twist of smoke. The only time my heart sinks, I tell Cameron, is when hikers show up. But it doesn't happen often, and they never stay long. And in many ways, that's true. I love being a fire lookout. I literally get paid by the United States government every summer to sit and stare out the window. Literally, that's my job. The fact that such a job still exists in the 21st century is no small miracle, given all the technology we have. Satellite imagery, unmanned aerial drones. But there we are, 10 of us in the Gila National Forest, on watch to call in wildfires as soon as they happen. And, you know, a fuller answer to my colleague Cameron's question would have involved the 65,000 words it took to write my second book, which is a sort of prequel to Fire Season. Do I ever get sad at the fire lookout? Yes. Truth be told, I do sometimes get sad there. On the other hand, it's also the case that that place relieved me of a deep sadness that might have otherwise devoured me. And I take up that story in All the Wrong Places, my new book. This book is, as I say, a sort of prequel to Fire Season. It fills in the backstory. Why would a outwardly well-adjusted seeming young man with a career at the Wall Street Journal and a degree in journalism from the University of Montana give that up to go live alone on a mountain? And there are about five different answers to that, including the fact that I witnessed 9/11 up close and personal, the fact that I lived in New York and could never get ahead monetarily as a journalist. But the biggest factor, which I just hinted at in Fire Season, is the fact that my brother committed suicide at the age of 22 in 1996. And I spent years after that event sort of lost. And this book is titled All the Wrong Places precisely because that describes where I found myself in the years after my brother's death, always in the wrong place. My politics were fairly liberal, so where did I end up working? The Wall Street Journal. I'm pretty Caucasian. I guess the word would be white. Where did I end up living? The most African-American neighborhood in Brooklyn, Bedford-Stuyvesant. Over and over again, I saw in retrospect, the place where I didn't belong. Because my brother's death had made me so uncomfortable inside myself that I wanted to bring my external circumstances into alignment with my inner discomfort. So how to do that? Put myself in a place where I didn't belong. Put myself in a place where I stood out. And I did that over and over again. And that is sort of the defining thread of this book. It's the story of how I did that and what resulted. The book begins and ends in New Mexico, and I'll come back to that fact later on, but the bulk of it happens in New York City, and I'll just read one little passage here that points out the possibilities, the narrative possibilities for me of writing about how I ended up in the wrong places. So at the Wall Street Journal, I got a job there in 1999. I was hired as an editorial assistant, which is a fancy way of saying the guy who goes around the office and hands out faxes to reporters as they come in over the transom. And when water coolers began to run dry, I was the guy who replenished them. I was called either an editorial or a news assistant. I had nothing to do with editorial content or news. I was the lowest level employee at the newspaper, in the newsroom. But after about 10 months, I got a raise and a promotion, and I became a copy editor for the Leisure and Arts page. This job put me in close proximity to the editorial page of the newspaper, which is sort of notoriously conservative. Some people might even say reactionary. And what happened there, one thing that happened there was this. Let me read it. When I moved to the Leisure and Arts page, I assumed I'd have no personal contact with the editorial writers, but my cubicle was situated smack in the midst of theirs. A couple of them came forward to welcome me, but most of them did not. The ones who welcomed me overlooked the fact that my politics were repugnant. Those who did not welcome me could not overlook that fact. Admittedly, by hanging a poster of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney reimagined as Beavis and Butthead in my cubicle, I made it a hard fact to overlook. I tried once to engage in a reasonable discussion about politics with one of the editorial writers. She worked in the cubicle next to mine, so I overheard her on the phone every day, talking the crazy with like-minded crazies, suggesting, for instance, that the U.S. Navy, after having been pressured to stop raining practice bombs on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques, should instead bombard the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, making it the opposite of a wildlife refuge. She cackled when she said this, though not because she was kidding. She wrote a lot about the environment. She was reliably against it. And one time I told her I disagreed with something she had written about federal forest policy. The essence of my argument was simple. I didn't think trees should be cut down carelessly. She told me that trees existed to be cut down. She said she actually preferred clear cuts, forests transformed into non-forests. She said clear cuts grew back as peaceful meadows, which were aesthetically superior to forests. I disagreed not just on the aesthetics, but also in regards to the effect on wildlife and watersheds. She said I had an unhealthy sentimental attitude about trees. In fact, she accused me of wanting to hug them. I told her I didn't want to hug them. I just didn't think they should all die and take with them songbirds and squirrels and all the other life that make an ancient forest more than a stand of timber poised to become lumber. She said most trees would be better off dead, after which they could be given a more useful second life as furniture, houses, or fax paper. We didn't talk much after that, although we always exchanged cordial hellos when passing in the hallways. At its core, this book is a book about the aftermath of a suicide. As a marketing tag, that's, pardon the pun, a killer. A book about suicide. Who wants to read that? And I was very conscious as I wrote this book that although I wanted it to deal with very, very serious matters, matters of life and death, I had to find a way to inject some levity into it as a way to draw the reader through the story and maybe even surprise the reader now and then with a laugh. And so one of the ways to do that is to mine the possibility of what happens to someone when they're put somewhere they don't belong. I liken it to, you know, sort of dropping a giraffe into the middle of a baseball diamond. That thing doesn't belong there, right? Are you going to turn away from the sight of it, though? No, because you want to see what happens. Something really weird is probably going to happen. Something unlikely and quite potentially comic. And so I tried to do that in this book, to look at those years as honestly as I could, but also look back at myself from you know, we're talking a distance now of 10 to 15 years or more, and be able to laugh at myself and what became of me in those years, even though what became of me was largely defined by my brother's death. And one thing that became of me in those years was my efforts to achieve intimacy with other people were profoundly, perverted, I guess you might even say. My working assumption in writing this book was that suicide is about the hardest thing to talk about in our culture. I found over the years that if you wanted to bring idle cocktail party banter to a screeching halt, say your drink needed replenishing, but you had been backed into a corner and you couldn't escape to the bar, how do you escape? Just drop the word suicide and watch everybody scatter and your path clear on your way to the bar. Make it a double this time, please. Because we just don't know how to talk about it. There's a kind of residual thread in Western culture which had long viewed suicide as a renunciation of God and a usurping of a power that should belong to God only, which is deciding when life should end. For a human being to take that power away from God was a grave sin, perhaps the gravest of all. And for centuries, people who committed suicide, their bodies were horribly disfigured, dragged through the streets, buried at a crossroads with a stake through their heart, the thinking being that the constant traffic at the crossroads would keep the soul underfoot and not allow it to wander among the living. And while we have certainly evolved beyond those sort of barbaric practices, we're still deeply uncomfortable with the subject of suicide. It doesn't take too many examples to show just how uncomfortable we are. The obvious one is a statistical one. We hear about murders in this country every day in the news. And the most recent year for which statistics are available, 18,000 people were murdered in the United States of America. That same year, 2012, 40,000 people committed suicide, more than twice as many people as were murdered. Did we hear about any of them? Do we ever hear about any of them? We hear about a few, particularly if they're famous, most recently Robin Williams. And even that discussion that arose around his death showed sort of how uncomfortable and weird it is when we talk about it. You know, the most memorable thing said about Robin Williams' death was Shepard Smith on Fox News calling him a coward. And that's not really a way to open into a conversation about suicide, to just simply judge someone, label them. That's, again, a way to shut down a conversation, I think. And yes, it's one way of viewing the act. It later came out that Robin Williams had severe health problems. And you might also make the opposite argument, that it was an act of courage for him to end his own life and to end his pain. But those ironies and complexities are sort of lost whenever we try to talk about this event. And rather in this book, rather than get up on my little soapbox and try to have my 2 cents worth about the topic of suicide, I wanted to write a narrative that revealed what happens to what are called suicide survivors. A phrase I've always found sort of peculiar. It's like we tried it ourselves but failed or something. Like the noose slipped or the cartridge jammed. But one way of thinking about us is that it's like suicide is like a bomb going off. There's one casualty who's gone, and then everybody else close by ends up with some shrapnel in them. And they carry it the rest of their lives, and it leaves some scars and some wounds, and they slowly heal over time. They never quite heal completely, and it changes us. And as I mentioned, I'm very, in a very circular fashion, getting back to my point that my brother's death made it very hard for me to achieve intimacy with other people. Nonetheless, I was a young man in my 20s, not without erotic impulses. I just couldn't figure out how to act on them because it was really hard to open up to other people, carrying around this essential fact of my existence that my only brother, a person I cared about very deeply, had chosen death over life. And so I found a way to cultivate that part of myself. And I'll just read a little bit of that now. If anyone has small children in the store, they might cover their ears and maybe find a quiet corner. No, it's actually not that graphic, I swear to you. And it's even, I hope, a little bit funny. But so committing to the life of a loner involves one difficulty above all others. Even loners, perhaps especially loners, often find themselves horny. In New York, whole industries thrived on the basis of this simple fact, and nowhere was this more evident than in the Village Voice classifieds. I began to study those pages with what I thought of as a detached and almost scholarly amusement, but one ad in particular kept calling to me with the promise of amateur phone sex. The very existence of amateur phone sex intrigued me. I had always assumed it was a realm for professionals. It wasn't long before I memorized the pre-recorded greeting. I even learned to mimic the inflections of the woman who recited it. "Thanks for calling the all-live, all-the-time phone line where ladies call free to talk dirty with you. If you're under 18, you must hang up now. Welcome to the exciting new way to talk one-on-one with the area's hottest students, housewives, and working girls for just 35 cents per minute, 75 for the first." Now, I knew the area's hottest students, housewives, and working girls weren't all sitting at home pressing speed dial with one hand while doing something else with the other. But when I called that first night, I thought I might get lucky and connect with an introverted bombshell, a naughty librarian. We'd talk about music or books or the Kyoto Protocol. We'd choose a place to meet for a drink. We'd proceed to her place or mine. Half the single people my age in New York were already using the internet as a portal to erotic adventure, but I had always been a little slow adopting new technologies. It was the new millennium, and I was still using a manual typewriter. "Main menu, press 1 for sexy recorded personals, or press 2 for live connections on the talk line." I pressed 2. "Press 1 to talk to women, or press 2 to talk to men." I pressed 1. "Live talk main menu, press 1 to connect with callers who are on the line right now. Press 2 to record or update your Dateline personals greeting." I pressed 1. I was drearily earnest at first. I stressed my status as a gainfully employed, suit-wearing monkey. I laid on the Midwestern charm, the whole small-town boy in the big city act. I waxed poetic about my love of music and books, going to museums, eating out, I was, in short, Prince Charming. A perfect gentleman straight from the script of a romantic comedy, just the push of a button away. Welcome to the talk line. Rarely have I heard such scorn. Women sent recorded messages in which they simply cackled at me. Some were incredulous. You're actually looking for a date? On this line? One even presumed to judge my anatomy. Come on, little boy, pull that itsy-bitsy teeny-weeny out of your pants and play with Mama. I hung up that first night completely demoralized. I wanted to be appalled at all the perverts and misfits on their telephones across the city, but I was mostly disappointed in myself. They, at least, were candid about what they wanted. And what did I want? There's no way I could have been honest about that. What was I supposed to say? I need someone to sleep with me so I can tell the story of my brother's death? That would have had the virtue of being true, as if the truth were a virtue on a phone sex line. Over the course of a few short-lived flings in the time since Dan's suicide, I had discovered that sex emptied my mind of everything non-essential, and the one thing that remained essential, I thought, was the story of his suicide. Everything else was a dream or an anecdote. Nothing else meant a thing, not compared with the big story, and I just couldn't talk about it unless I had bared myself in physical intimacy. Hard to imagine working that up as an attractive come-on, though. Hey, sweetheart, let's screw with our eyes closed and then snuggle up for some pillow talk about the mysteries of self-inflicted death. Will you listen if I tell you? And so, in time, I worked through my initial misgivings about phone sex. I did the practical thing. I listened and learned. The rules were simple. You could lie about what you looked like. Who would know the difference? But you had better be blunt about your desires if you didn't want to waste anyone's time. With a bit of practice, I developed a whole portfolio of personae, ranging from the iconic to the cryptic. My go-to line? Clark Kent calling from a phone booth. His ready-made image allowed me to dispense with laborious physical description. He was also the perfect fantasy man of the women's magazines, a reliable breadwinner, a modest but hunky journalist, who morphed into Superman when he took off his clothes. So, I go on in that vein, probably uncomfortably long for my poor mother's sake, who has read this book. But I thought it was very important to try to be as honest and as candid, and I would even say as pitiless, when looking back on what my life had become in those years after my brother's death, because if you're going to take out your little hammer and chisel and try to chip away a few flakes from the massive edifice that is the taboo of suicide in our culture, you may as well do it with as sharp a tool as you can. And my thinking was the sharpest tool available to me was ruthless honesty. There seemed to be no reason to go halfway in writing this book. No reason to hold back on what my brother's suicide had made of my life, how it had disfigured me in some ways. And I don't want to leave you with the impression that it turned me into a misanthropic hermit, although I do spend 5 months every year as a misanthropic hermit. But the other 7 months a year, I'm in society. I spent years as a bartender. I like to think I was a jovial host in the adult beverage industry. I do like other people. I don't rely on phone sex anymore to make connections with people. And in fact, although the book is called All the Wrong Places, I end up in the end in the right place. And it's sort of the kind of story you couldn't even get away with in a novel. It's a story that, to me, just reveals how strange and lovely life can be. Because I begin the book in 1995 with the last time I saw my brother alive. This was in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I drove down to see him because he had recently become engaged to be married to a young woman who was his boss's daughter. And I thought, upon hearing this news, you know, we've sort of been out of touch for a while. We were brothers in our early 20s, living on opposite sides of a vast country, pursuing our separate interests. But I really ought to meet the woman who's going to be his wife before the week of their wedding. So I used my college break from school to drive to Albuquerque and spend several days with my brother and meeting his fiance. And one of the most extraordinary events of my life happened on that trip. Dan was 21, I was 22. I had never been on a commercial airline flight before. I was a pig farmer's son from southern Minnesota. I sometimes say a shit-kicking pig farmer's son from southern Minnesota, just to emphasize where I come from. And so my brother had discovered a passion in Albuquerque. Albuquerque's known as the hot air ballooning capital of the world. And my brother had become taken with this pastime there. He bought himself his own balloon. He started training how to be a hot air balloon pilot. And while I was visiting him, he took me up in his hot air balloon. And it was the most extraordinary thing, perhaps, that had happened in my life to that point. Looking at the world from above, 2,000 feet above the ground, in the sunrise light of an Albuquerque morning, with the Rio Grande, a thin little thread off in the distance at the base of the Sandia Mountains. He showed me something that morning about himself, his competence, his artistry, his skill. He showed me something that I probably needed to know, which was that this was no longer my little kid brother. This was a young man of great, great talents. And he also gave me my first glimpse, my literal first glimpse of the world from above. I'd never been off the ground higher than a flop off a high diving board. And I knew even as it was happening, as we were flying in the basket of that balloon, that I was experiencing something I would remember forever. As I mentioned, that's the last time I saw my brother. Due to a sort of misunderstanding, a stray comment that I took the wrong way, I chose to not maintain contact with him at the end of that visit. Some words came out of his mouth that so troubled me, I just thought, you know what, maybe he isn't as grown up as I thought he was, and maybe when he does grow up, I'll reconnect with him. But until then, I don't need to put up with that BS, because he said something that I thought was just flat-out racist, and I couldn't take it. I didn't want to tolerate it. I wish now I'd had the courage to confront him about it, because we might have maintained contact. Instead, I chose to cut him off, and I never saw him again, and I never had a real conversation with him again in the last year and a half of his life. And that haunted me. it's a good part of the reason I think why I ended up in all the wrong places for those years, because I thought I had let him down, probably. I had judged him, written him off, and severed, perhaps, a connection that might have sustained him through his darkest hour, which ended with him choosing death over life. And 6 years later, a friend of mine invited me to come to southern New Mexico. She said, "Listen, bub, I know you're ensconced in your cubicle there in lower Manhattan, but you should get your flabby white butt out of that chair and out from behind that computer screen and come down to southern New Mexico, where I've managed to get a job as a fire lookout with the U.S. Forest Service. It's 5 miles from the nearest road. You got a hike to get here. Come on down, check out the view, and breathe some fresh air for a change." And so I thought, yeah, I should do that. On my way there, I made a stop in Albuquerque. Over the years, I had made many, talking to people who had known my brother, trying to learn something about him, perhaps that I hadn't known, connecting with people who knew him better at the end than I did. And on that particular visit, I tracked down his ex-fiance, the cause for my last visit to see him in Albuquerque. And she asked me if, at the end of an evening of dinner and a couple of beers, asked me if I had known about my brother's secret. And I thought to myself, no, I don't know any secret. That doesn't ring a bell. And it took some coaxing for her to cough it up. And I won't spoil it if anybody here tonight decides they want to read the book. But what she told me put his life and his death in a new context for me. And as terrible as it was, what she told me, it allowed me in some way to forgive him for ending his own life, to understand perhaps why he wanted to, why he had carried a pain with him that he wanted to end. And literally the next day after being told this piece of information, I'm driving south toward my friend MJ and her fire tower. And we met in town. We drove up the mountain road to a pass high in the Black Range, where we parked, and then we hiked in 5 miles to her lookout tower. And when we got there, we set our packs down at the base of the tower and climbed the 65 steps and popped through the trap door. And when I walked into that space, this is a little 7 by 7 foot room with glass windows on all sides, I had a strange sense of deja vu. Like, I've been here before, but of course I hadn't been there before. It took me a while to put my finger on it, but there I was looking out the window to the east at the thin thread of the Rio Grande, at the base of the Caballo Mountains, which called back a sensation of looking at the thin thread of the Rio Grande at the base of the Sandia Mountains 6 years earlier. And just a sense of dignity and grandeur of being in a very high place looking down on the world. And I was there for 3 days on that mountaintop, by the end of which I had talked myself into the job. I was going to stay there. And I realized later, yeah, okay, there were a lot of things at play. I was tired of daily deadlines in newspaper journalism. I had seen and, quite frankly, inhaled 9/11 way too up close and personal. I was not making any money or getting ahead in New York. There were lots of reasons for me to jump at this chance to leave New York, but it's a pretty big jump, you have to admit. Working in the financial district of Lower Manhattan for a brand name news organization, one of the most powerful in the world, to become a wilderness fire lookout for $12.80 an hour. It's not the most rational of moves. But it appealed to me because it allowed me every day to live close to what was best in my brother. That little tower still to this day calls back for me the basket of that hot air balloon and what my brother showed me the last time I saw him alive. And I feel as though I can perpetuate something good about my relationship with him by being there. And I'll just close with this brief little paragraph that describes the connection I finally made between these two places, these two experiences. So having seen two towers reduced to a crumble of rubble on fire on 9/11, I couldn't help but appreciate the poetic reversal of watching four fires from a tower in the wilderness. It felt like a useful act of witness, like journalism minus the obsession with ephemera. But it's also the case that in my renewed grief for Dan and all that he had suffered, I wanted to honor the gift he had given me the last time I saw him, the gift of an incomparable view of mountains and desert from above the great rift valley of the Rio Grande. From the moment I stepped foot inside the 7x7 foot cab of MJ's tower, I was reminded of the basket of Dan's balloon and the unimpeded view from her peak, a view that included the great rift valley of the Rio Grande, called back that long-ago feeling of flight, the dignity and grandeur of floating eye-level with distant mountains. I wanted to perpetuate that feeling. I wanted to live inside of it again, remaining close to what was best in him. If it took an act of intentional downward mobility to do so, trading a job in journalism for a vocation less than a quarter as remunerative, so be it. That great sweep of sky more than made up the difference. The adventure he had dreamed of but never attempted, soaring over the Sandias in a big wind, I could live a version of it every day. Afternoons amid the lightning, mornings above the clouds. And with that, I thank you for your attention. Yeah, if anybody has any questions, fire away. I'm happy to answer anything. Or we could retire for a hot cup of tea. It's entirely up to you. Yeah, one question here.
At the beginning, you mentioned something about how it was great that you still had this job because of technology and everything. I mean, is that a job that will go away at some point because of technology? I mean, why is that still something that we still need humans to do?
It's something we still need humans to do in certain places because we're still the best way to spot wildfires quickly and early. You know, people talk about the various ways it might happen in the future. Unmanned aerial vehicles, satellite imagery, motion detection cameras. But none of those things have evolved enough to beat a human being with a pair of binoculars at seeing a single tree struck by lightning sending up a little puff of smoke 20 miles away. And we're cheap. As I mentioned, I think I'm getting paid now $13.16 an hour, 14 years later, due to cost of living adjustments rising ever so slightly. And so there are 10 of us in the Gila National Forest. That's 130 some odd dollars an hour to have total coverage of the forest with 10 pairs of eyes. $130 will get your observer airplane maybe to the end of the runway. And because humans can sometimes start wildfires, you can't have constant aerial surveillance. It would be so costly. Yes, you can send them up after lightning storms, which is generally when there will be new wildfire starts, but many of our most destructive fires are started by humans on very hot, dry, windy days. And so we're still in places that aren't heavily populated the best bet. Now, in Southern California, somebody driving down the freeway is going to look up and go, oh, there's something on fire up there. And, you know, the switchboard is going to light up and 712 people are going to call it in. In a place like the Gila in southern New Mexico, which has 750,000 acres of roadless wilderness, that's not going to happen. You need somebody somehow, some way, watching from above. And so until the day they make technology better than a pair of eyes and cheaper than it is now, we'll hang on in places that have big roadless wilderness that has a fire risk in it. And I hope that lasts at least as long as my knees last, because I love this job and I need to hike 5 miles to get there. I'm 3 knee surgeries in now at the age of 42, so we'll see how much longer I can do this, but I hope it lasts. Other questions? Yeah. We get a weather forecast, very detailed, read to us over the two-way radio every morning by the dispatcher, so we sort of know what to expect. Part of our job, in fact, is to take weather measurements ourselves. So we take readings of wind speed and direction, temperature, relative humidity. That's just done with a simple little sling psychrometer where you have a wet bulb and a dry bulb and you spin it around and the difference tells you the RH. And then we measure precipitation, both daily and keeping a log of accumulation over the course of the season. But I'm pretty cut off from anything that it could be called technology per se. I don't bring my computer there. I don't have an internet connection. Until last year, I never had a phone there. We had an incident where a lookout had an accident on horseback and was killed, actually, a very close friend of mine. And since then, they've mandated that we bring cell phones as an extra line of communication. And I can pick up a sort of dubious cell signal there. It doesn't always work great. I have a propane refrigerator and a propane stove, and that's about it. So it's pretty stripped down for 21st century living, you know? But I kind of like it that way. It simplifies matters, and it allows me to be creative. I'm not clicking on Amazon to see the sales rank of my book every half hour to see if somebody's buying it. You know, I'm not tempted to click refresh on ESPN.com to see, you know, have the Twins signed their prospects and are the Vikings looking good this week? You know, those temptations do sort of grab me in my day-to-day life. But there I'm unplugged, blissfully so, and I find that so conducive to my creativity that when the day comes and they say, all lookouts must have laptops, high-speed internet, so that you can download real-time lightning maps, that might be the day that I hand in my notice. Even though all of those things would probably make the job easier, perhaps, I kind of like the old-school way still existing in the 21st century. It's so anomalous. It's so out of place. It's like, hard to believe that we still do it that way. There's nothing that's changed about my lookout job since about 1950 in my location, and that's pretty cool. You had a question? Yeah, that's a good question. Both of my books have arisen out of notebooks that were the result of the habit of writing every day. Just sitting down, you know, sometimes I didn't even know what I wanted to say, but you touch ink to paper and something happens, some little spark goes off and you start writing, and it's often just a process of discovery as much as anything else. You don't have a plan necessarily, but something happens if you make a habit of creativity. And so I actually worked on the new book, what we're calling the second book, for about 4 years. And I struggled with it, and I failed, and I wrote bad draft after bad draft. I wandered down many a cul-de-sac that I couldn't see my way through and just backed out of. And then I happened to meet a young editor in New York who took an interest in a diary I showed him of my lookout job. And he published it in a literary magazine. And short time after, he asked me, "So what do you think your first book is going to be?" And I said, "Well, I've been working on this book about my brother and his death for years, and you know, I think I'm making progress finally." And he said to me, no, "That's not your first book. Your first book is about being a fire lookout, because that's the book only you can write. I mean, who even knows fire lookouts still exist in the 21st century? The field is wide open. You know, the last installment was in 1970 or something from Edward Abbey in an essay." So he convinced me to drop the project I had been involved in for years and write something totally different. And what I did in that case was, because of my habit of writing every day, I just went through my stack of notebooks and tried to discern patterns, because it turned out there were patterns season after season unfolded in a similar way. I hiked in at the beginning. There was a little bit of snow left on the mountain. Then it got really windy and dry for a couple of months at least. Fire season got underway and fire danger ramped up. And then we would get some lightning and all heck would break loose. And then eventually it would rain and fires would calm down and we'd get enough rain and that would end the season. So the arc of the book was easy to see, and the chapters were easy to name: April, May, June, July, and August. And I just mined the notebooks for what was most interesting, and what was most illustrative of the experience. And when I was done with that book and went back to what became All the Wrong Places, I realized I could do the same thing. I had notebooks from those years after my brother's death because I wanted to talk to somebody about it, but it was so hard to talk about, I could only talk about it with myself in private notebooks. And I did, at great length. And so I went through them again meticulously and tried to tease out what threads were illustrative of the experience. And what I found was this story of how I had worked myself into all the wrong places as a kind of punishment for my feelings of guilt toward my brother's death, and also as a way of bringing my external circumstances into alignment with my inner life. And I wrote draft after draft. It took, in some cases, 20 drafts to get it right, because I wanted to say the least amount necessary to tell this story. and I wanted it to have not a single wasted word, and I wanted it to have the narrative momentum of a really good novel, and I wanted to leave out the self-pitying, the lugubrious, and the boring parts. I always joked about the first book that I wanted to write about a book about sitting and watching mountains all day that left out the boring parts. And that was the trick, right? You know, you set yourself some big goal that sounds kind of insurmountable, and then you try to surmount it. And with the second book, it was how to write a book about suicide that would leave out the lugubrious, self-pitying parts and even make people sometimes laugh. No small trick. But again, a big challenge, and if you set yourself that kind of big challenge, I think you can urge yourself to strive for something lasting. And so, for me, it was about robbing and borrowing and stealing from my notebooks and just sitting down in the chair every day. It's an old saying, but amateurs wait around for inspiration. Professionals just put their butt in the chair and go to work every day. And that's what I did. I just wrote every single day and generated massive piles of paper and kept a tiny fraction of it that seemed worth keeping. I was written in numerous ways. Handwritten in some cases, typewritten on a manual typewriter. And, of course, once you get far enough along, you have to have it in your computer because it's so much easier to revise on a MacBook Pro than it is with whiteout on a typewriter. So, you know, the last couple of years of work on the book was all revising on a typewriter. I'm sorry, revising on a laptop computer. Yeah, one question back there. I am using the same machine that Cormac McCarthy uses, I'm proud to say. Probably the only thing that connects us. An Olivetti Latera 32. Comes in a neat little carrying case with a handle, and it was relatively light and small at the time it was first made, and so it was the preferred typewriter of foreign correspondents in Vietnam and places like that. Because it came in its own little snug suitcase and weighed a mere, like, 8 pounds or something. It's harder to find people to repair it, and I have to send emissaries to a little shop in Greenwich Village in New York City to buy the ribbons, which are harder and harder to find. But I've always liked a typewriter, in part because the sound mine makes is like it's like you're actually doing physical labor. Granted, you're doing cerebral labor, but it has a kind of kinship. Yeah, I know there is an app for that. There's an app for everything, but there is an app for that. But I kind of like the sound of construction, keys hammering on the roller. There's a rumor, unconfirmable, that the typewriter in my possession now was once owned by Barry Hanna, the short story writer. Really great short story writer. A friend of mine went to school in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where Barry Hanna had taught, and somehow in some auction or some raffle, he won this typewriter, my friend, and was told that Barry Hanna had once owned it. And he gave it to me because he already had like 6 or 7 typewriters himself. He was also a writer. And I did some poking around on YouTube one time for videos of Barry Hanna. And I found one that showed this light blue Olivetti typewriter in the corner that's exactly the color of mine. Now, I know there were probably tens of thousands of them made that same color. But I like to think that someone who wrote some really great short stories once put his fingers on those same keys. Yeah.
Do you plan on writing novels?
You know, I'd like to. I tried to write this book, even though it's a memoir and everything in it actually happened in real life. I tried to write it so that it would read like a novel. And I think that I'm inclined to write narrative-based stories. And so I did my apprenticeship writing fiction and got all the bad stuff out of my system writing terrible short stories that no one should ever have to read. And then when I was just kind of starting to get better at it, I switched to writing essays. And I've been doing it ever since for about the last 12 years. But part of me does yearn to go back to fiction and the freedom of that and see what I might come up with. I don't know what I'm going to do next. This book really emptied the well. There was nothing left for me after I was done with it. And if I go back to my fire tower this summer, sit very quietly, and let the well start to refill again, I'll be eager to see what's there. I don't know what it'll be. Well, I appreciate you all braving the winter weather for this, and thanks for your attention. I hope if you read the book, you find some things to like about it. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.